Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello, I'm Andrew Main, and welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm joined by Justin Robert Young.
That's me.
Mr. Brian Brushwood.
I'm told that's me. I'm a bit unawares.
And
thank you, Skype. This episode of the After Things podcast brought to you by Skype. Skype. It's time to upgrade Skype. Don't worry. It genuinely won't bone your podcast.
Ridiculous.
Thank you very much Skype to our crashed. Sponsor, Skype. And now we now return to our in-progress production of the After Things program.
This is really weird. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
You
can hear.
Yeah, I can hear you now. You're frozen in the other screen.
I can hear. Can everybody hear each other?
Just a reminder, when you're thinking of video solutions for your podcast, whether they're coast to coast or just across town, make sure that you use Skype.
Well, right. Yeah, I guess.
Okay, hold on.
Skype just take.
So
I guess Skype just took it down.
Woo. That's. Hey there, partner. Ever wish you had four throats? Then what you need is all Skype.
Right. I think we're back.
All right.
Ridiculous.
Hello and welcome. Oh, sorry. Start over.
Yeah. Keep all of this. Keep all. Wait,
are we still echoing?
Yeah. I got it. I'm handling it. I'm working on it. They're... All right. Take it away.
Hello and welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hey.
Brian Brushwood.
Hey, man. I assume everything's great. This episode brought to you by Skype.
Yeah. And our super producer extraordinaire, Bryce Castillo.
I'm going to pull out the last hairs that I have. I only got this hair on the top of my head. And I'm going to pull it all out because of freaking Skype.
I got two stories. What I want to talk about the Banksy thing. I want to talk about that. Totally want to talk about that. But first, I want to tell you this kind of, I read this. I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool. So there's a company called Brex, which just did a Series C funding round, which means first you do a Series A, then you do a Series B, then guess what, a Series C. And Brex got a $125 million raise, meaning they've got $125 million invested in the company. They have a valuation now of $1.1 billion, which makes them a, quote, you know, unicorn company. But don't show the headline just yet. When I get to there, because it's fascinating, is that this is a company that's created a credit card to make it much easier for startups and businesses to basically, you know, keep track of spending. You can get it without, like, it's a very easier way for emerging businesses to get lines of credit. And they're very, very detailed with credit reports. And so it sounds like they fill a really good niche. You start a business and you want to do this.
It might be that they're a high quality product. I would like to believe, you know what, it might even be that they've identified an important niche that needs to be filled. I would love to believe that it's because of their clever slogan, Just Brexit.
Yes.
No,
Brian.
Long way to go.
All right. So here you have a company that's got some people.
I vote leave.
You give a vote of no confidence.
They've got certain people who've been Max Lechkin, who was one of the original PayPal mafia, Peter Thiel, some other people who've gotten in, their former executive officer of Visa, Carl Pasquarelli, and some other people who've been behind it. So we've got a lot of really good people who support it and believe this is a possibility. They've identified a really solid need for this area, and they've created a product. What makes it interesting was the founders are 22 years old. And meaning they've been doing this company. They started this company like 2 years ago when they were 20, and they've been building this solidly. Now they're 22 years old, and they are heading up a billion-dollar financial company to Brazilian kids. They are from Brazil. They met together. They liked coding. You know, their moms didn't really think the coding thing would lead to anywhere. And I guess they made some like first games, which were maybe were infringing copyrights. They got like, you know, cease and desist threats. So they decided, Franchetti received what he discovered. He got a cease and desist when he discovered a jailbreak from the iPhone. And I guess he got grounded from that. But they stuck with the computing thing. And they tried a couple different companies. You know, they ended up going, I think, to one of the startup incubators where they had an idea for a virtual reality company, which wasn't going to fly. But the people there said, hey, you guys seem to have a really good grasp. Well, actually, no, these people said, you know, you have a pretty good grasp of finance. Why don't you go into that? And so that's what these kids went into, and now Rex.
So this is a case where being an old and busted old man may be tempting. Whenever you hear the words, you know, billion-dollar company and 22-year-olds, it's tempting to think back to where you were at the age of 22. But, of course, they did not start at the age of 22 like so many of us did. It really makes you reflect on I'm going to go out on a limb and say, did these guys go to college? Did they go and spend 4 years getting ready to do a thing and then show up on the bottom of a ladder and work their way up? Or my guess is they just started trying things at the age of 16 that they tuned themselves into an unmet demand that the universe had and then dialed in and went to work on it. Good for them.
Yeah. Well, apparently, I guess what they did is they were like 15 years. This 15-year-old kid, he started his first company, which had like 800,000 users, but couldn't make money. He closed that. He met the other teen, and then they created Pagar.me, the Stripe of Brazil. It raised 30 million, had a staff of 100. Then they sold it. And so they had that. They built that success. And then they came to Silicon Valley to build stuff because they seemed so big and cool here. Right? These kids, they're like 20 years old. They've already had like, you know, a $30 million, you know, raise. And then I don't know how their exit was. And they come to Silicon Valley like to go learn from them. I'm like, I think you guys kind of figured it out. But and then they came here and I think they did Y Combinator. As they wanted to do, you know, a virtual reality setup, you know, startup with their Y Combinator. Like, you guys seem to have done a pretty good grasp of, you know, finance. So here you have a case of some teenagers. They met, they started programming, they created a company, they had an exit, which exit can mean anything, but they built something. They built up a staff, they did something amazing, and then they go to Y Combinator with the idea of starting a virtual reality startup. And the advisors there are like, you guys need to know payments. And so they do that. And now, $22 billion company, which is amazing. And Brian, you're about to make a point about that.
Oh, just that like it's tempting to, when you hear about kids being billionaires, you think to yourself like...
they're not billionaires. They're maybe 100 millionaires at most.
Okay, so. All right. Well, good. Well, let me reset all this. But meanwhile, like if I was going to guess, given our climate, that their play to get there, I'm going to guess, number one, they did not go to university, which is not to say that nobody should go to university, but...
Brian Brushwood says nobody should go to university.
As Ryan Holiday points out, he says, if you're going to school, if you're going to college to learn a thing, and you have the opportunity to go straight to doing that thing, the time and the get-aheadedness is more valuably spent doing the actual thing rather than taking classes peripherally related to the thing so that you can get a piece of paper that makes you a more reliable hire to begin at the bottom of the ladder at some other place. So my guess is, as teenagers, they just dove in, got started, and failed fast, as the credo in Silicon Valley goes.
Yeah, and I mean, the takeaway I had from this wasn't like, oh my God, they made a ton of money. It was like, here are two teenagers that saw a problem and identified a need they perceived as a need, and they had people who got behind them. And it was, there is this sort of cat. I go to these startup events and you see 99% of these people, it's cash grab sort of things. It's somebody's like, we're going to deliver blank in a box, you know, or we're doing this. It's like, you're doing this because you hear these exits or you hear about these Series A funding and you think that's the goal, you know, which maybe, but it's like, here, I'm in love with stories where people, hey, I saw a problem, I created a solution, and now it's cool. You know, like, you know, Jack Dorsey and the crew with Twitter is amazing, but then with Stripe was like, hey, payments are hard. Let's do this. PayPal, other things, you know, Uber, all these, Airbnb were like, hey, here's a problem. And sometimes to make these things work, you know, like, you know, nobody thought like Airbnb at the time was going to be this big thing, but they said like, no, there's a real need here. There's a real problem here. And let's try to solve it.
This is, as we put it, I taught a class with Rex Williams of the Whiskey Tribe. We did a thing on, you know, building a tribe through online video. And the three key elements we kept hammering on are niche, type, and spice. You know, type is the structure. What kind of show are you? Are you a how-to show? The spice is, what are you doing that's different from everyone else? In the case of the Modern Rogue, you might say, yes, it's a lot, an awful lot like Mythbusters, the type, but the spice is, you know, what if it was two Adam Savages, neither of which knew how to do anything? But the most important part is the niche. When you think of, just as Darwin had postulated a tree of life where you got branches for lizards and branches for flies and branches for protozoa and so on, if there was a gap that was unfilled, then we would grow into that niche. There's also you might postulate a tree of brands. You know, there's a place for restaurants, and then it branches off into fast food restaurants versus sit down enjoying restaurants. And then the fast food branch splits into one where it's like, just give it to me fast, McDonald's, give it to me a little bit slower. But this time it'll be healthy, like with Subway and so on. Likewise, we talked about all this in terms of niches in the podcasting space, you know, in new media. The Whiskey Tribe was able to go in, I guess, under 2 years to from nothing up to over 100,000 subscribers, because they recognized that, yes, there were people on YouTube giving reviews of whiskey, but there was nobody doing it. And also, this is the spice and the type, whatever, was injecting storytelling elements and ridiculous backstory lore about a bear and an eagle and the mooch gods and all this stuff. And that's what's really engaged their audience. But I think that same idea very much lives in the world of business in general, not just in the media side of things. You know, in this case, these guys recognized that there was an open niche. And yes, there were other structures that were close to it, but whatever it is that Brex, what is the sneaky twist? What would the spice be on the Brex thing?
Focusing on small businesses that have trouble getting corporate credit cards, you know, giving entrepreneurs credit limits, giving credit to people who haven't been able to get it.
The niche being, there's a need for people running small businesses to get credit. Yes, there are credit cards already, but so the type is, let's do credit fulfillment, and then the spice would be, but let's go out of our way to make it really convenient, really easy to build structures in. Let's predict in advance all of the things that we know small businesses tend to need when it comes to accounting and all that other stuff, and advice, and make that super, super easy. Good on them, man.
Yeah, and I think on the subject of spice too, I think that a good point out there is that, like what Whiskey Tribe did, from what you're describing, is they found a thing that made it appealing to an even larger audience. Often people say, I'm going to do this, I want to do a comic, podcast. It's great, but I'm only going to cover comics from 1963 to 1965 during this niche. It's like, that might be appealing, but now you're getting really narrow. You're, instead of taking a large audience, you're now trying to carve out a small audience, which may not be bad, but you have to understand, like, it's this, does this make it appeal go wider or narrower?
Well, and which can work if you so you satisfy a niche that is specific enough, but then and the type is obviously, the structure is, I'm going to cover comedy stories from blank, blank, and blank times. So you make it a narrowly defined niche, and by virtue of owning that niche with that type, by being first, you now own it. But then the spice is the weird thing that has a tendency to expand the niche, to actually make the niche more interesting. And Business Wars, the podcast I talked about before, is the perfect example of this. We are hearing classic stories of business warfare. That's the type. The spice is, this dude doesn't give a dry accounting of everything, but instead actually acts out both parts and puts in sound effects and music and sets the scene and tells a story. So that's the spice. And in doing so, causes me, like, I am now far enough into the podcast that I'm starting to listen to stories that I inherently have no interest in, but I trust him and his storytelling acumen and the way he runs all this.
Sure.
At this point.
I guess maybe let me give a better example. Like, I'm going to do a sci-fi news site. Great. But I'm only going to do interviews with cast members of Babylon 5.
That's a starting point. You don't have to remain there.
I think it's, you know, but in that could be great. And there should be things like that out there, but that's the thing of where it's, but if it's like, hey, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to do interviews with people on old sci-fi shows and stuff and get stories, then it's bigger. That's cool. Cause then we'll do a run on Babylon 5. Then we'll do a run on, you know, Blake 7 or some other nerdy. Then it's like, oh, well, I'll probably come in when it's some show that I liked. And then I might stick around for these other interviews at some point.
In the chat, Drunk Furball already has a title, Babbling 5. He'd listen to that. That's great.
I think that's the thing, is to think of like the spice is how it helps get bigger. Niche, going in a niche is good to focus, but don't, you know, take that and applies elsewhere. You know, another, your topic about food was interesting. Have you heard about Cloud Kitchen?
No.
Well, one of the things, and I may have mentioned this before, if you're in like New York or some big cities and you look up like Uber Eats and you look at some of these dining places, you'll see like, you know, White Orchid Thai Cafe, you know, you'll see, you know, the Down Home Country Barbecue or whatever. There aren't actually physical stores for this. There aren't actually physical restaurants for these. These are just kitchens where they make the foods and they make them under a bunch of different names. Right. And so somewhere in, you know, the Bronx, there's a food kitchen that prepares this stuff. And Cloud Kitchen is one of the startups. And I think Travis Kalanick of Uber is one of the people behind this, where the idea is, let's just create this factory kitchen where anybody could go there and say, hey, I want to create my own little restaurant brand. These are my recipes. And basically, like, provide the staff and everything to create an entire restaurant where you kind of don't even have to own anything physically.
Oh, wow.
So Brian's on the website now looking at this.
Theoretically, does this mean that a same physical space could be 7 different restaurants every week?
Yep.
That's amazing. That's wonderful.
Yep.
But these are delivery only, so that space.
Sure. But how far until all of a sudden, you know, you create a modular thing, and we've alluded to this kind of idea before, but like imagine a modular space where it's like you press a button, all of the lighting changes, all of the screens throw up different art, the ambiance is whatever it is, and basically it's like, okay, Thursdays and Wednesdays it's going to be a French bistro, and Mondays and Fridays it'll be whatever.
Yeah, I think that could be a thing, but I think they're trying to go in the opposite direction, say like, let's, like, food delivery is becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. In the same way that, like, you use cloud resource and lower the cost, if you get rid of any of the real estate costs completely, like, I order, like, I don't go out as much as I used to because, like, I use Amazon restaurants and Uber Eats, like, all the time because I'm lazy. And that's, for a lot of people, that's continuing, you know, that's the trend. And that's, like, so they're like, but now let's lower the cost of starting a restaurant to the average person. So, you know, for tens of thousands of dollars, if you have some restaurant idea, I don't know what the costs are, but I imagine it's, you know, you could start your own delivery service now without ever having to.
This is like
basically they want to create a food truck esque, like take what the agility of and daring of a food truck menu, right? But even eliminate that expense and say, hey, look, now the new food truck is what lives inside your Uber Eats and Amazon food and Grubhub and all that. So you really just need a portal that can exist within these already, that the frameworks for delivery, people are already just coming over to a window and picking up food anyway. All you really need is a good idea, and we can help you get staff to cook it correctly.
This is,
if you click launch a kitchen.
You just click launch a kitchen?
Have like get in contact with us, but their goal is, you know, basically to facilitate, make it very easy. We provide private kitchen equipment, so you build the business. So I don't know if they're into supplying the labor or whatever for this, but they have to provide, eliminate the burden of upfront costs, eliminate much of the CapEx for kitchen equipment, reduce permitting time. You don't need any permits, eliminate non-food labor costs. So
this is like basically, I think, and this is not an ad for Squarespace, but this is like the Squarespacing of opening a food business, because the one thing even the average Joe knows is that fastest way to lose all your money is to decide to open a restaurant because there's so many infrastructure costs, and then you get embroiled in bureaucracy, and that, you know, and then it takes months and months for you to find out whether or not your vision is going to resonate with the local community.
Yeah, I think that what they do is, the idea is they open up a bunch of these ones all across cities and stuff and small locations and stuff, and then you go staff and put them in there. But then we've talked about before, like the factory kitchens and stuff, and I think we're going to get to the point where it's going to be like, hey, here's my recipes, here's this, you staff it, you hire this, and I'm going to go advertise this is available. I mean, think about that, where like you could take your favorite recipes, go online, put them into a kitchen, do a test order, get the order, make sure everything tastes right, go back, say, we need to fix this, and then all of a sudden, you know, you've got rogue food.
And plus, once you crack the code for, let's say, North Austin, how easy is it to use this service to duplicate it in South Austin, then Austin, then San Antonio, then Dallas, then Houston?
If you feel like, oh yeah, these, you know, like, because you could have like, here's the ingredient list, and you can request other ingredients, and you could pay a certain amount a month to have certain ingredients on, you know, this, and you could, yeah, you could create like, I mean, I think we're seeing, that isn't what this is, but I think that's where we're going to go. And particularly like if you're a trainer or you're somebody who's been diet programs and stuff, because like we do this now with, like, you know, the supplement industry and custom tailor-made stuff. We do this in manufacturing, but the idea of, hey, you know, I want to open up a delivery service that could be nationwide. Here are my recipes. This is the company I have do it, because I know they faithfully replicate this stuff. That's an amazing idea. What?
Real quick, because I could tell Justin has a thought on this, but it sounds to me like this is MP3s allowed the democratization of music distribution. YouTube allowed the democratization of being a video producer. This sounds to me like a democratization of, you know, a lot of people don't know that your Wendy's, your Burger King's, your McDonald's, they're all sourcing from Cargill or some other major, you know, they make a run of a bunch of Wendy's food, shut down the lines, and now they're going to make a run of Burger King food, and then they shut down the line, and then they're going to make a run of the next thing, and then they're going to keep on a continual loop. We just have that at a faster cycle, available at a lower budget to more and more people.
Yeah.
Well, and you are taking advantage of natural trend lines that you are already seeing. I think, you know, food trucks were a big step forward, and like, all right, I have money to open a restaurant, or I have skill to open a restaurant. I want to do something. Can I do this cheaper, easier, or more agile? Right. Like, can I eliminate, like what Brian said, the biggest problem with a restaurant is, let's say I have everything right. I nail absolutely everything in terms of the menu and a staff. And everything, except I didn't have enough money to get the location that would have been better, or I wound up overspending on getting a location I thought was going to be perfect, and it just is not there for the foot traffic, right? Or something else happens that gets in the way. So food trucks took that idea and said, you want to know what? All I know is that I can just go drive this truck to wherever people want to go, wherever people want to buy this thing. Cool. I can figure that out. My opportunity is endless there. This is fascinating in that you are also eliminating, there are so many Postmates and Uber Eatses and Amazon of the world that you eliminated the idea of, okay, to be a delivery restaurant, I need to hire a delivery staff. That now there already exists. You can just basically make what this is trying to boil it down to is just making a food API that, you know, that you can just say, oh no, I'm just going to do is I make the best Korean tacos. And so I'm just going to be able with a little bit of, you know, outsourcing and they even said marketing in there. So I'm sure that you could probably just go there and say, hey, look, I make the best Korean tacos. I would like to put this much money into it. Now you guys are going to set me up to the point where I'm going to have a kitchen, and you'll show me how to integrate into all these platforms. Might even help me with a logo and formatting my menu in an appropriate way, and maybe even getting into the SEO of trying to buy into the advertising. But at that point, now really all you have to do, like, you are as likely to succeed as there are people that are searching for Korean tacos in your area, or would be interested in buying Korean tacos in your area, when, like, even then your runway is so much larger because you're not focusing on getting training up an entire staff, building up an entire menu that you're going to serve. Like, you can be hyper specific and limited. And as long as people want to buy that thing, now there is less of a barrier for that to succeed, which is just crazy to think that we're in that position.
I see this expanding. I mean, this is if you're a person that wants to run your own kitchen and do this, this is great, because you call them up, they provide you the kitchen, you can go cook there. So it's like, you know, they've already done the trouble of finding where to put these kitchens. You know, co-working kitchen space sounds great. The next step of being able to contract out to the factory and making it easy for anybody to be able to go to that and take the ingredients list and do that, I think is amazing. I think what we're going to have to see happen, if like the factory delivery kitchen succeed, Amazon's going to start buying, like, we'll buy one of the bigger, more successful ones and expand that. And that's kind of a thing I think we're going to get into at some point, is that, you know, you're going to be buying you can already go to Whole Foods, but your delivery and your everything else, like, you know, your food's going to be made in an Amazon kitchen, delivered by an Amazon delivery person, and, you know, for better or for worse.
Specifically, also, it's like, on the one hand, it's like, yeah, it's a bummer to, like, it was a bummer. I forget which airport it was, where we were flying. I think it was United, they have the whole terminal, and you have all these different storefronts with all these different, you know, there's a steak place, there's a chicken place, there's a sushi place or whatever. And then you figure out that they're all just different faces to the same back end, and that they all use the same terminals. You're like, oh, wait, United owns all of these. That's why they all have exactly the same integrated terminals, and somewhere there's one big kitchen back there. So on the one hand, it is a bummer, because I think that we do love the fantasy, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I mean, like, you know, we love the illusion that these are independently owned businesses. But also, my guess is 100% of all the food there is clean and relatively parasite-free, partly because of it being assembled by one large company that has to keep up with all the latest health regulations.
You know, I would actually go the other way and say we are now moving into a world where you are closer to saying, like, all right, well, these ribs are good, but they're not like my friend Doug's ribs in you know, this other place that I used to live. And now we are so much closer, because, like, if you're able to, let's go into this factory kitchen world, right? And now Doug can just import all the specs that he uses for his ribs, and maybe it's not going to be exactly the same, right? But you can get a closer version to it, and you can spread. We are now, like, yes, we are commoditizing home cooking, and so we are losing on some level the preciousness of, oh, these were cooked by the hands that cooked them all the time, right? We are moving a little bit away from, you know, Jiro dreams of sushi, but we are going closer to, man, this one burger place I used to go to in college put garlic salt on their burgers. I wish somebody would just put garlic salt on burgers. Like, and now we're going to have that in such a faster and agile way.
Well, and here's the part that we have to get more comfortable with, is the idea that that so much of our subjective experience when we go to a restaurant is really the stories that we tell ourselves and the stories that they tell us. Like, it matters if a place is, you know, around the corner, or let's say disguised as a floppy disk repair company, then that is part of the story of the experience of getting into a speakeasy and then requesting high-end cocktails. Like, there's nothing magical about those cocktails, but the experience matters for all that. And so, so substantively, there's nothing about this that can't be done by robots, and eventually there will be. So essentially, the role of the storyteller, the role of the artist, becomes to craft a narrative of experience for everybody. We saw that with the Alamo Drafthouse. Alamo Drafthouse does not have the greatest food on the planet, but they go out of their way to tell a story about presentation, a movie, about the subversiveness of what they were up to, even though they've since had to institutionalize and franchise it and make it a little more commoditized. So much of those early days still survives what began as this punk rock thing.
This is your white whale, is Alamo Draft House not playing YouTube clips and or not playing copyrighted material before the movies.
Well, and even then, the fact that they've gotten right with, you know, a sustainable large scale version of it still makes it, I think, better than the place across the street from us.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, no, definitely. I mean, listen, I could do with a few less toy commercials during every superhero or Star Wars movie. But all in all, it's a nice, pleasant a thing to walk into when you're about to go see the movie.
Right.
In a totally unrelated note, Banksy, the provocateur, was able to make headlines this week. Did you all see this?
I did.
I love the fact that this has been the headline on this in reality is Banksy rewards person who paid tremendously high price for item by making it insanely more valuable.
But the headline that was first was like, you know, Banksy, you know, so what happened is Banksy, there's a Banksy print that is like, you know, girl balloon or whatever it's called. And it's this girl reaching out this heart balloon that would have been in a private collection. And then it went up for auction at Sotheby's. And the moment that they reached the final bid of like, you know, like approximately $1 million US, an alarm went off and the print was in a large, suspiciously large frame. There was a sound went off and all of a sudden the print started to fall downwards as it was being shredded, and it shredded itself 2/3 of the way. And it was actually the final thing was it was like this portrait hanging out of a frame, half
like,
shredded.
Much like a Pokemon. It finally evolved to its final form. You were bidding on it. I gotta tell you, I have a real complicated relationship emotionally with this type of conceptual art, and it's taken me a while to understand the value of art in general. Specifically, and I think reading Sapiens, reading Homo Deus has really made me understand that art is a military technology. It's the reason that only one version of genus Homo still exists, and it's because we had the power of art to inspire, to rally to our cause, to use as a shorthand, to recognize others of our tribe, and to project the specific onto the general. This is the kind of story that would probably, at the age of 17, I would have hated, but at the age of 43, I adore. And I justify and I think is important because what this person wanted to buy was a story, and hot damn, did Banksy over deliver on that story that this person got?
I was going to defend my Neanderthal ancestors. They made art too. There's a lot of just so stories that I've subscribed to about why we survived and why they didn't. Some are appealing, but it may be more complex.
Sure.
Than
no.
That.
Correct. I can't wait for you to read Sapiens because I suspect that you'll have some really interesting takes on some of the stuff he said. But in general, it was stuff like gossip and the ability to construct myths. You know, oh, you worship the god of the 12 strings, so do I. Therefore, we can flexibly adapt and take over.
I'm looking forward
else.
To it, but I highly recommend John Hawks, his blog. He does a lot of great coverage. He's a guy, he's a researcher in this. He was the Homo Naledi. He's a guy that found that. And there are things that I said, oh, this makes great. Like, you know, one of the things, my favorite stories was like Neanderthals didn't appear not to trade beyond their own groups. And
except
we'd
they
only
totally
find,
did.
What's that?
Except they totally did. Is that
well,
that what
no, we, I mean, we still don't like, we would find like, you know, we would find in Neanderthal graves, we'd find none of the rocks they had came from more than like a few miles away. Where Homo sapiens, contemporaries to them, we would find them from hundreds of miles away, which implied they had trading networks that were bigger. And that's a thing that I'm like, oh, maybe that's a thing. And there was some things that we thought about Neanderthals. They didn't do this, but then we found, wait, nope, here's a case where they did do this because it became, and so I'm on my own point, I've bought into sort of, well, they didn't do this thing. And that's a case I think still might be true, but other things like, maybe they did, maybe they didn't do as well or whatever, but maybe it is a complex story. And I think, you know, maybe we did have higher capabilities of abstract thought. So I don't know, but we'll read it. We'll talk about, but I highly recommend John Hawks, his blog, because he's really good at covering a lot of stuff and some of the myths that are popularized by other people about this.
Sure.
But yeah, but back to the, sorry, the Banksy thing is like, the thing that, when you first read the headline, you're like, oh my God, he totally got them. But then you find out the painting was sold at the very end of the auction. Also that it apparently been in the collection for years. And you're like, well, that seems, you know, the battery still worked and all that worked. And then you find out, you know, Banksy has this company called Pest Control, and they're the ones that authenticate Banksy stuff. So if Banksy stuff goes up for sale, they're the ones that go in there and authenticate it, which tells you, like, Banksy's a commercial enterprise. There is money to be made from Banksy, and one of the ways that Banksy can make money is that he can do private placements of stuff. You know, if all of a sudden, Dr. Dre wants to buy a Banksy, he can buy a Banksy, and Banksy's friends and people like this will facilitate that. That's how it works. So he's not like he's this guy that's like who's issued money or anything else like that. And that's never, I don't think that's his point at all. And so, there's an enterprise there. There's a commercial enterprise there that's very clever what they do. So the theory is that Pest Control, which is the group that goes in to authenticate, probably rigged this thing. And I'm personally inclined to believe that Sotheby's was in on it because they placed it last. And, you know,
let's generously say, like, hey, we're not going to tell you what, but, yeah. And maybe this is the whisper network of them saying, like, not going to say what, just going to say this one, well, you probably want to be the winner of this auction.
And the amount that it sold for was a very clandestine amount. It was the exact same amount as his previous auction record of a painting, which is. That's something where it feels controlled on the buying side as well.
They set. Do you think like word got around like, hey, if this gets to 1.4 million, you're gonna be pretty glad you have it.
It could be.
I don't know enough about the art market to know where this was. Like, I mean, aside from I read the same thing that Bryce did, but here's what I do know: you are thrilled if you have this. Like, yes. Sure, if given the choice between a regular framed Banksy with that exact same design or this one, you're going to want this one. Art is inherently made more valuable by the more people talk about it, and we are talking about it right now, which probably has some kind of calculatable value added to it. So I think this is one of those great things. It shows, tell you what, you want to talk about a brand? Banksy knows his brand, and whoever it is there, that it is a business, it is a brand, it is something that they were able to say, oh, look, aren't we super cool for not only taking $1.4 million, but then also, or after Sotheby's gets their cut, whatever, how much, you know, Banksy or the private seller who was selling it gets, but then also totally driving up every other piece that is going to be sold, because now you'll have at least some kind of reasonable thought of like, oh, I wonder when this one's going to spit acid in my face. Like, $2 million for me, sir.
It's certainly, it's a wonderful thing that, you know, I mean, it's I loved it because like this is delightful. The way that the story got carried just shows you sort of the idiocy of the way kind of modern journalism is, which is probably the same as old journalism. And I think that what's kind of funny is like there was an auction around this time last year, which made waves in the art world, but didn't go beyond that. Do you know like the highest paid ever for a piece of art is?
No. What?
Well, I think this may have set the record. Last year, a Da Vinci portrait of Christ sold for $450 million.
That's a lot.
Now, the problem is that, like, I hear there's some speculation that it may not actually be a Da Vinci, though. I don't, you know, there. I think there may be some debate or that. And that's the sort of thing where, I mean, it's, you know, it's great, but I kind of like the Banksy thing. I kind of like, because I mean, like, we're all big Da Vinci fans here. Don't get us wrong. But if you want to talk about something that's kind of more impactful or interesting and made more waves, this Banksy piece, you know, now granted,
I mean, geez, and whoever buys it, you now have influence beyond that money can't buy, right? Yeah. Like this is something that you could then give, I'm sure, any modern art museum would love to have it and would love to probably pay you. You can tour this thing around the world now and make money or gain influence. Like this is beyond just being a talking point that you can have in your own private collection. This is something that now will be, it is in a world where art doesn't become famous, you know, like that we appreciate the things that have happened in the past. This is art becoming famous in front of our eyes on a level that we very rarely see.
Yeah, I feel like it's a case of questions being more interesting than answers, because the moment you read this headline, you think, well, would it be worth more or worth less if it was cross-cut instead of shredded? Is it more aesthetically pleasing this way that it didn't finish, or do we wish it did? I don't know. I think it's a fascinating thing, and I think that it's good to probe those weird side depths of arts. I think all of us are in love with a thing that we're still trying to figure out why we're in love with it and what parts of it we're in love with, and whether that's specifically Banksy, whether it's that it's the nature of his highfalutin pranks, whether it's the nature of being in love with the stories associated with art in general. I gotta tell you, man, more than ever in my life, I feel like there's a value to that.
I agree. You know, we talked about this with SpaceX and, you know, MZ, the guy who's funding the whole send artists around the moon. It's like, yay. I don't know personally I'm going to gain a lot out of that, but I know that a lot of people will. And I think that's a neat thing. And the Banksy thing, it's Reverend Banksy's a guy that, like, I don't necessarily think that I'm on board with all of his political views or his on stuff, but man, bless him. Like, I'm glad that he's out there, you know, saying things, being provocative, doing stuff, and doing it in a very entertaining way. And I you know, I've said this before, I've talked about this last, we're talking about Kanye. Like, this is a guy, like, I don't know what he's saying to be able to say that I agree, but, like, I like the fact that he's not afraid to say something. And I like artists and stuff that are just going, hey, think about this, or take a look here, look over in this direction. This is what I think, but at least I get you to look and think about something that's outside of your wheelhouse. And I think that's,
I mean, all goes back to what is that art piece from 100 years ago where somebody just put a urinal in the museum?
Piss Christ. No, I'm sorry. You're not that one.
It's quite literally.
Duchamp's fountain.
Yeah, that's right. Duchamp's fountain. Again, you read these books from brain scientists where it's like they're like, man, oh man, do people instantly have an opinion of whether or not that's art? And I don't know, I for one encourage that debate.
Would we have thought differently about this if the painting was fully destroyed, either by some sort of chemical reaction or a fire or something, or like, so let's say, like, now it is, like, not, because even if it had shred all the way through, you can still put that up, and now it's aesthetically something interesting. If it's just burned beyond recognition, like, do we think better or less of it?
I think that is why we appreciate what we saw, because we saw the equivalent of him barrel full speed towards a cliff and hit the brakes at exactly the right moment to where everybody is sufficiently horrified, shocked, and amazed. The purchaser is even more happy that they bought it, and everything was on brand in a way, you know, because it's like, on the one hand, it's like, you know, where does it end? On the other hand, it's like, why not burn down all of Sotheby's and murder everyone on the inside? Now it's really good art. Enjoy those ashes, right? So I think that's the... similar to in the days of NSFW, we knew that there was an artistic comedic value to playing fast and loose with real money, the money that was keeping the show afloat by being dangerous in our ad reads. That's what we just saw right there. Whatever that thing is the same fire that you and I played with.
Yeah, I think you know, the Banksy started as a graffiti artist, which, you know, destroying people's property. Of course, now, you know, people wished it was, you know, they had some of his early stuff, you know, really isn't that good. But people wished they'd had his their property destroyed by them. What's interesting though was like when Banksy did his, you know, his famous New York residency, you know, where he's going to show up and did like 30 pieces around there. What I thought was interesting was some of the stuff he did were illegal and like, yeah, I think he'd punished like any other graffiti artist, whatever. Like, he's not above being punished in my opinion on that. But my thought was like Michael Bloomberg was doing the press conference to, you know, say, yeah, you know, we'll punish him. We're going to catch him, or we're going to after him or whatever. I'm paraphrasing here. And it's like, and I'm like, what do you think your role in this is now? Like,
yeah.
Like it's fine to have like this, you know, the police commissioner may issue a statement, say like anybody else does, this is a crime, whatever. But when Michael Bloomberg goes up to a podium and says, you know, like the freaking mayor of Gotham challenging Joker or something, you know,
yeah.
It was just like, I'm like, the optics on this aren't good for you, mayor. But, you know, not to say, again, let's say like, yeah, the absolute should, you know, if he's illegal, then prosecute it. But you know, that side note, like, this is just, I don't know. I think this is a cool thing. It's worth really analyzing the story behind the story because it's going to be instructive and thinking about, you know, like Brian very clearly said, you know, said, or, you know, there are lines there. There's a line between, you know, like, you know, it created an even more interesting art piece, had the thing totally combusted and gone on fire. Well, then it could be insurance fraud, you know, and it was a very clever thing. Now, what's funny is there is one recognized Banksy art project that Pest Control will not authenticate. And that was at a music festival years ago. Banksy had made a bunch of English pound notes or 100 pound notes where he replaced the Queen with Lady Di.
It sounds to me like that's the kind of thing. A friend of mine, David Rowan, once wrote an essay about the matrix of moral and ethical when it comes to the world of magic, or I guess legal and ethical, and how they're not necessarily on the same thing. And he postulated, is it possible to do a magic trick that is ethical but illegal? And of course, the answer is yes. If you full on counterfeit a bill, it makes it a very convincing magic trick, and you are definitely breaking the law in order to do it. However, you could easily make the case that this is an ethical piece of art because there was never the intention of having somebody exchange it for goods or services. So it sounds to me like that's the artistic territory that he was trying to thread.
Yeah, so people will have those notes. Well, problem is immediately people try to spend those notes at shops and stuff, which again, you're probably better off now had you done it, but like, had you kept it or whatever. But yeah, when people try to get authentication from Pest Control, they're like, nope, not authentic. It's not an authentic Banksy.
Yeah.
No. Which I think they go for a couple hundred bucks a piece now.
Hey man, I don't want to be a broken record, but I feel like for picks, just for you, I would love to hear your take on Sapiens and Homo Deus. If you get the chance to read those books, right. I think there's a lot you would like in there.
All right. I don't know. It's on my Audible.
Add that to the list. In all your free time, Andrew, just jump on in.
My pick is going to be a former Weird Things guest. Aubrey Sitterson just released his comic book history of professional wrestling. It is really, really good. I've always known him to be a really cool storyteller, but this traces the history of professional wrestling back to its literal origins between wrestling matches and carnivals and where things began to pick up steam with the Goldust Trio, all the way up till modern days and how much media has depended on it. But very, very well done. The art is super fun, and I would encourage everybody to go get it. The Comic Book History of Professional Wrestling.
Awesome.
Oh, very cool. Exit Through the Gift Shop was actually a documentary theoretically produced, you know, claimed by Banksy. And it's about another artist. I think it was Mr. Brainwash. Very interesting sort of thing about sort of our thing. And there's some people say that the whole thing is the whole documentary is actually a mockumentary. Which
our friend Rudy Kobe insists that is not the case. He says he was there at that time in that scene, and that Mr. Brainwash really is exactly as presented in there. My bummer about this movie is that the subtitle is constantly called the Banksy movie, and yet it was not about Banksy. It is about Mr. Brainwash.
Now, and I know Rudy, I've talked to Rudy about this. Like, yeah, I mean, that was like was a real installation, a real thing, real this, whatever. But a lot of things in the art world, like kind of like sometimes they're collaborative. You don't know they're collaborative. And most of it is, hey, we're going to do a thing. We're not going to tell anybody we do a thing and we'll make this thing happen kind of thing. So as far as I don't know, but I'm making, and I'd say that every documentary is a mockumentary. Every documentary yes. is a mockumentary to a degree, but it's really, it's a very, very interesting sort of overview on that. The other one I would recommend is, I think it's Banksy Does New York or Banksy Like This, which was about like the 30 day, whatever residency did that. And it was very interesting about the reaction to that. And, it's kind of interesting, 'cause like there's another one, like I think Stealing Banksy, whatever, which was Banksy did this. One of the installations was this like small, like brick Sphinx that some dudes saw and they're like, well, we're taking it. And they picked it up, loaded it in the back of a truck, and went off to go sell it. And there are people like, oh, how dare you? And I'm like, I don't know that that's any morally worse or better than, you know, putting something on the side of a building that's not. I don't know. I mean, like, hey, I made this piece, and now it's out there. And it's like, it's out there open to the world or whatever's going to happen. And you'd see some examples like Banksy put a balloon thing on the side of a building, and some guys tried to grab it, and cops stopped him and all this. And it's like, I think that's part of it. I get that it sucks that these people took this thing because they wanted it for their own, but it's like sitting there on a public street and it's like, you know, I'm if you see a Banksy, grab it. You're like, oh no, you're going to die. Other people like, yeah, but it's going to get grabbed.
Man, so. Then you get into the interesting question of degrees where it's like, let's say an art piece involves the act of shoplifting. Would I get it. This is a artistic piece, a live action performance art of the act of shoplifting. Well, I'll participate by committing the act of murder. You know, it's like, you know,
that's not a gray line for me, Brian.
Specifically, like I don't know, like defacing property and theft of property. That's interesting. I don't know.
Interesting questions. When a piece is on the street and it's abandoned like that, in theory, it's abandoned. You could pick that up. That's a thing. And so, like,
right,
you know, and so that would, the city could maybe claim, and that might, like, you know, things and sort of like, yeah, this is on somebody else's property. Like, there was a case of a balloon thing on a building. And some guy went up to it, like, no, that's on that building. That is, belongs to that building. And that to me, that's clearly theft. I'm climbing onto this building, which does not belong to me, to do this. When Banksy puts something on a public sidewalk or a street, it's like, it's abandoned, you know, it's clearly there. It's, you know, it's like,
wait, what this makes me think of is the art piece where they put the defiant girl in front of the raging bull on Wall Street, where they did it without permission. And so the question is, well, do we remove it or is this the new story or what right does not the artist have to alter the context of, you know, the original artist's art and all that stuff.
I still don't understand the intent of that piece. Like, the bull represents, like, a growing economy. And then I'm like,
and like, a little girl wants to stand in the way of it. But also,
yeah, I'm like, I don't understand this.
Say what, like, man? This questions are better than answers. That's what makes all this so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it was cool. I mean, I was like, it's cool they did that. But I'm like, wait, what's the I don't know. I think the message here is not, you know, clear to me.
Sounds like a whole separate episode of After Things, because I feel like there's, that would be a fun thing to break down what you see and all that.
Yeah, I don't know what the artist intent, but yeah, it's cool. But that was, and but, and you know, the story between the bull and the bear too, like, I think those were like spontaneous.
Oh, sure. The metaphor about like a bear economy and a bull
economy. No, I mean literally like showing up. I think the
original walls. Oh, really?
I want to make this go long.
Which, by the way, Drunk Furball in the chat says he thinks they repurposed the image of the bull to stand for the patriarchy. You know, now you're probably right, and that's certainly the way I read it. And then the question is, what right does one artist have to co-opt someone else's art to change it?
Yeah, or it's like, okay. Like,
yeah. Oh, so the charging bull, the Wall Street Bull, is a bronze sculpture, stands in Bowling Green, originally guerrilla art installed unofficially by Rodrigo de Mónica. It's popularly led to being a permanent feature. It was another.
That's so amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this feels like a whole other episode.
Yeah. Cool. All right, gentlemen. It's been weird. but it's after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.